Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and the decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Kyle Hammerness, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We are here today to discuss Lackey v. Stinney, which was decided by the court in a 7-2 decision on February 25th, 2025. It is my honor to introduce our guest today, William Maurer. Bill is a managing attorney of the Washington State Office of the Institute for Justice, where he engages in litigation in the areas of economic liberty, private property rights, educational choice, and freedom of speech. And with that, I'll hand things over to Bill.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. So Lackey versus Stinney, as you mentioned, it came out in February, and it was a 7-2 decision. And it concerns the application of statute 42 USC 1988, which provides that in relevant part, that the court in its discretion may allow the prevailing party, and here I'll read in prevailing party in a civil rights suit, other than the United States, reasonable attorney's fees as part of the costs. And the precise issue in Lackey versus Stinney that the court was looking at was whether civil rights plaintiffs who obtain a preliminary injunction in a case that they have brought under the federal civil rights laws and who obtain some degree of relief through the granting of the preliminary injunction, but then who are unable to complete the litigation because the case is mooted. In this case, it was because the Commonwealth of Virginia's legislature repealed the statute at issue. Whether they qualify as prevailing parties under Section 1988. And prior to the decision in Lackey versus Stinney, the answer to that question was pretty straightforward. All 11 circuits that had looked at the issue said, yes, they are prevailing parties for the purposes of 1988. The U.S. Supreme Court granted cert, which is unusual in cases where there is not just a split in the circuit, but overwhelming unanimity, and decided that they are not, in fact, prevailing parties, and that in these circumstances, they should not recover fees under 1988. So the case, let's back up a little bit and talk about the case itself. It was initially filed in 2018, and the substantive claims in the case concerned a Virginia statute that permitted the state to suspend the driver's licenses of people who had failed to pay their court debt. That in and of itself is a fascinating issue. It was litigated in front of the district court which granted a preliminary injunction. And the preliminary injunction pretty much gave the drivers exactly what they wanted. They got to drive immediately. And the enforcement of the statute was suspended against them. And the litigation was actually somewhat thorough. There was extensive briefing, there was evidentiary hearings, and the district court's decision came out, and it was very substantive as to why the district court thought that this was in fact an unconstitutional policy. After that decision, while the briefing was going on for the Fourth Circuit the briefing was going on on the merits for the summary judgment argument, the Commonwealth decided to move for a stay, arguing that the statute was likely going to be mooted. And that's exactly what happened. The court granted the stay and the legislature repealed the statute. The plaintiffs moved for fees under Section 1988. You may recall, I just said that all 11 circuits had held that they were entitled to fees under this provision. Plaintiffs in a similar position were entitled to fees. that actually was not the case when the plaintiffs moved for attorney's fees, because the Fourth Circuit was the sole outlier. And the district court denied them on the basis of the Fourth Circuit decision. The Fourth Circuit then went up to the panel of the Fourth Circuit, which again denied the fees. The plaintiffs moved for rehearing en banc. And at the en banc decision, the Fourth Circuit en banc joined all the other circuits to make it 11-0 in favor of granting attorney's fees for people who obtain a preliminary injunction, but whose case is then mooted for some reason. As I mentioned, the Commonwealth petition for cert, which the court granted, which was probably a bad sign for the plaintiffs in the case, because it's, as I said, there was not only not a split, but the courts were unanimous in holding that this was the correct outcome. And the court accepted review, and as you mentioned, it reversed the Fourth Circuit and rejected the reasoning of all 11 of the circuit courts, and held that civil rights plaintiffs can only recover fees when the court rephrase that. They defined a prevailing party as someone who obtains enduring relief on the merits that alters the legal relationship between the parties, and that this relief has to come from a court. It cannot come from the state legislature or any other kind of intervening activity that would otherwise make the undo the purpose of the lawsuit. And now the holding of the U.S. Supreme Court is that in order to obtain fees under Section 1988, you have to have a final decision from a court that alters the legal relationships between the parties. It has to result from a judicial order, and it has to be permanent.
Right. So, thank you so much for that summary. Can you dive a little bit deeper into the reasoning behind the decision? Because it does seem like it almost came out of nowhere before, where, as you said, all the circuits agreed. How did Chief Justice John Roberts and the other six justices come to that decision?
Well, the court actually built on an earlier decision called Buchanan. Buchanan was a case that rejected it wasn't under Section 1988, but for the purposes of this discussion, it was very similar to Section 1988, rejected what's called the catalyst theory for the recovery of fees, where some circuit courts had held that if you sued a defendant in a federal civil rights case and the defendant basically gave up, that served as the lawsuit served as the catalyst for the change in the law, and that thus you were a prevailing party in that case and entitled to fees. And in a 5-4 decision, the court said, no, prevailing party is a term of art, and it dates back to, they looked at the definition of prevailing party when Section 1988 was enacted. And over a very strong and I think persuasive dissent from Justice Ginsburg, held that prevailing party means there had to been a court order that results in a change in the legal relationship between the parties, that it couldn't just be the other side giving in. And like I said, that was based primarily on treating this term of this phrase prevailing party as a term of art, even though in a concurrence Justice Scalia argued strongly that this was a term of art. We have to look at the history, we have to look at dictionary definitions, and which seems odd because he is such a textualist that they that if the court wanted that Congress wanted to condition fees entirely on a person winning the court case, they would have said they can obtain fees if they win the court case. And they didn't. They just said it was prevailing. Prevailing means basically you've got what you wanted. I kind of called it the who gets the what kind of phone call do you make to your client rule? Basically, is it a happy phone call or is it a sad phone? If it starts off with, I have some bad news to tell you, you're not a prevailing party. But if it starts off with, hey, great news, the legislature repealed the law, the city council stopped enforcing this, we got everything we asked for in the lawsuit, even though there's not a final order, that means you've prevailed. You're the winning party. And the Stinney decision, I'm sorry, the Lackey decision really builds upon Buchanan to say that it's not just that you have an order that changes the legal relationship. It has to be a permanent order. It can't be a temporary order because that temporary order might go away at some point. I don't find that a particularly persuasive argument because the reason that the temporary order is only temporary is because you've achieved all of your objectives. And as we pointed out in the amicus brief that we filed with the ACLU and other groups, oftentimes a lot of preliminary injunctions are granted in cases where there isn't time to have a full, a full-scale trial or a full case. For instance, we want to stage a protest tomorrow. We need a preliminary injunction that would allow us to do that. We get the preliminary injunction, and then we stage the protest. The case is essentially over. But there's never going to be a decision, a full decision, a permanent decision on merits. But we've got what we wanted. And nonetheless, the court rejected that in Lackey and said that. Building on Buchanan, it said it not only has to be a judicial decision that changes the relationship between the parties, but it has to be a permanent judicial decision that changes the relationship from the parties. And that permanent decision has to flow from a court and not from the actions of the legislature or from some third external force that occurred.
Okay. And then because it was a 7-2 decision, obviously two justices disagreed, and Justice Jackson wrote the dissenting opinion, with Justice Sotomayor joining her. Does Justice Jackson go into this, use this previous case, use Justice Ginsburg's dissent in that case to kind of bolster her argument against this decision?
No, actually, she doesn't. She very much relies on court precedent to hold basically that there still has to be a judicial decision, but it doesn't need to be permanent if there is some other permanent relief that is obtained by the plaintiff. So she was trying, I think she tried to fit her decision into the Buchanan into the Buchanan box, but it is a I think that was a little more difficult than arguing simply that Buchanan should be overruled. I mean, I can understand why they're somewhat hesitant to embrace over the four liberals on the court are somewhat hesitant to embrace overruling precedent at the moment, but it made it somewhat difficult. But it's not entire. It wasn't completely off the wall. It was pretty well grounded in both a case called Buchanan and in Soul. Soul also dealt with a preliminary injunction, but in that case, it was a preliminary injunction that the court granted. And then at the end of the case, decided that the plaintiff should not prevail. And the question was, is the fact that they got some remedy during the course of the case in the form of a preliminary injunction, does that make them a prevailing party? And I think, Soul basically said, no, you lost. And I think that is the, you know, the real distinction is that, and that's one that Justice Jackson, I think, really heavily relied upon, which is that the judicial decision in favor of the plaintiffs in this case, and this was a substantive decision. This was not just, this is, you know, this law is very unfair and it'd be terrible. You're probably going to lose, but we're going to, I'm going to enjoy it anyway. This was a substantive decision. Like I said, after, you know, substantial briefing and after an evidentiary hearing, Justice Jackson, I think, correctly said that that is not the same as Soul, because at the end of the case, the plaintiff's attorneys got to make the happy phone call, and the defendant's attorneys got to make the sad phone call. You know, she also looked at the fact that if you look at the statute itself, it doesn't say final order from a court. Other federal fee shifting statutes do say stuff like that, and this one does not. And she also pointed out, I think, you know, very correctly, and this was another point that we tried to make in another several amicus briefs from across the ideological spectrum, including the Alliance Defending Freedom, pointed out that the entire purpose of this statute was to allow people to get into court to vindicate their federal civil rights, and that it was incredibly important to Congress that they be able to do that without it completely making, you know, wiping out all of their savings or using up everything that they have on attorney's fees. And it would also make it more likely for small law firms and public interest groups to represent federal civil rights plaintiffs in vindicating their civil rights if there was a broad policy in place encouraging the collection of attorney's fees for prevailing parties. So the decision that the majority issued in Lackey, I think, was very much inconsistent with the congressional purpose. I think it was inconsistent with the actual language of the statute. And it's also, I know a lot of people don't like legislative history, but the legislative history of Section 1988 made clear that Congress did not intend to condition attorney's fees awards on a final judgment from a court. And those are all three things that Justice Jackson, I think, very persuasively set out in her dissent. I think those ultimately those were correct, but the losing argument. You know, Chief Justice Roberts, in his majority opinion, pointed out that if we're interpreting Section 1988 incorrectly, Congress can reform the law as it did in other circumstances involving attorney's fees. But I think Justice Jackson correctly points out, well, it's our obligation to get it right the first time and not have to worry about Congress coming back and saying, okay, we'll say this again and say this time we mean it.
Okay, I think that gives us a great launching off point into you know, some of the consequences that stem from this decision. And I know you touched a little bit on it, but how do you see this changing litigation going forward, especially in the civil rights context, as you mentioned? Because it does seem like this will have a big impact.
Well, I think the impact is going to be, you know, collectively, that it's going to be fewer civil rights cases being brought. It's going to be an encouragement for city councils and state legislatures to engage in gamesmanship in order to avoid having to pay fees. And I think it creates a weird incentive for plaintiffs to add claims that would prevent the mooting of their case, even after they've achieved all of the relief that they really needed. And it also creates an incentive for them to litigate to the bitter end, so that they can so that they can collect fees at the end of it. So I think, Chief Justice Roberts discussed a lot about, judicial economy, and, that this is an easy to apply standard. It's easy to apply, but I don't know if necessarily will result in judicial in saving judicial resources. I think it'll create other types of litigation incentives. But I think the biggest issue is that it is, like Buchanan, it is a step in really restricting the intent and the reach of Section 1988, which Congress really, I mean, the legislative history and reading the legislative reports about this and the debates, this was really designed to get people whose federal civil rights have been violated into court without them having to be to worry about being impoverished. And to open up the doors of the federal courthouses to people of limited means, to be able to vindicate their rights, because the Department of Justice can't do it all. They can't vindicate every single person's rights. This was the creation of private attorneys general. And a key part of that was be able to have people with the resources to be able to collect this. So this creates it a like as I mentioned, a disincentive for small firms, to solo practitioners to take federal civil rights cases. It creates a disincentive for smaller public interest firms to take civil rights cases. And I think it's inconsistent with Congress's intent. I think it's inconsistent with the language of the statute. And hopefully, or one hopes that Congress at some point will correct the Supreme Court's reading and make it even clearer than it is now that these types of this type of situation where you achieve everything you needed, and you forced the defendant to do what you wanted, means that you have prevailed and are entitled to fees.
Okay, well, I think that was a really, really great summary of everything that really is part of this case. And I just want to thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, my pleasure. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. SCOTUS Cast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers. Founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental power is essential to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUS Cast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.